Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Parmenides of Ella, a reading from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy about a pre-Socratic, before the time of Plato, Socrates and Aristotle, one of the founding philosophers. Didn't write a lot, but is someone who is there sort of like a foundation tributary to the main current river of philosophy, if you like. He was from 500 BC, 551 BC, and that's before Christ, so you count backwards and forget the zero. There's no zero BC or AD, so it goes, so it's you can't subtract it. It's not like a number line, so it goes, he's minus 3, minus 2, minus 1, 1, 2, there's zeros missed, so that's just an important thing to think about. So he was a philosopher, and back in the day he wrote a philosophical poem, a very long poem, the introduction of which is called a proem. And the poem itself is lost, but there's these commentaries on it and transcriptions of sections of it. So, thousands of years later, we can reconstruct it. And, it's a, not as we would understand a philosophical work, a modern philosophical work. It's a, fantasy, almost as what you would call probably science fiction. But before there's science, there's religious fiction, a religious fiction work. And these chariot turns up for him with beautiful sun goddesses and beautiful mares, not male horses, female horses, take him all the way up to the night palace. Not the night garden, but the night palace. And he meets the goddess of night, and justice lets him in, and he sits there and he listens to this goddess go on, and this goddess describes philosophy. Now, the central part of philosophy is that nothing exists, because nothing is changeable. But then, contrary to this, he has a description of a cosmology which describes everything. So there's two parts to the poem. As far as I can get, I'm just going off the top of my head from it. And so going back, there's this, was he a, monist, is he strictly a monist who believes that there is only one thing, the existence is only one thing, therefore it's unchangeable, etc. Was the contradiction meant to be in there, such that, I'm just going back, was the contradiction meant to be in there? It's called meta. Is it a meta principle? Is this supposed to actually talk about a fundamental principle of philosophy, problem of philosophy, rather than actually dictate it, or is it a dialectic logical point? Was it just making a logical point? So these are the various interpretations and various schools of thought. My sixth school of thought is that there's probably two authors, and he was probably drunk when he wrote it. The aspectral. So we come to 3.4. So one was his life, two was the poem, three was the interpretation, and we've done three interpretations so far. We're on to the fourth interpretation, and I should warn you, these are long-winded things. And this is the aspectual interpretation prevailing in antiquity. So this is how he was interpreted in antiquity, and aspectral means without spectrum, and spectrum comes from the word ghost, but I think it means that it's an ungraded idea. So he's written something, it's the foundation from which Plato and Socrates met or heard of the guy, and it's a paradox. It's sort of one area of philosophy. I don't know how it fits in, but it's Parmenides. So Parmenides was one of Plato's books, where Plato wrote a screenplay with him in it. So you can't see the movie, almost like a documentary Discovery Channel. So Plato was really like a ancient Discovery Channel person. So we'll read the text here. The idea that Parmenides' arguments so problematize the phenomena of change as to make developing adequate theoretical account of it a central preoccupation of subsequent pre-secular natural philosophers is a commonplace of modern historical narratives. So so when they go back, he just happens to be there. They happen to write about him, and he had a difficulty of really working out whether anything existed. Sort of like he got to step one of a maths problem and just froze. So I feel like that many times. And so this is what we believe, but indeed this book is going to tell us something differently. Unfortunately, this new this notion has no real ancient authority, i.e. there's nothing in the ancients which really suggests that people really look at it. Aristotle's account at physics, and they've got a point, of the wrong turn he claims early natural philosophers took in trying to understand principles of change has often been thought as a legitimate this view, given that eclectic sounding arguments it records. Okay, so given that they've, what they're saying is that we've given him this Parmenides, and he's stuck with it, and Aristotle's answers that it's not necessarily he was preoccupied. Eleatic means from Ella. This is the school of Parmenides. But Aristotle mentions Parmenides nowhere in the passage. And his complaint is in fact broadly directed against all early Greek philosophers whose views have been surveying previously in the book. Okay, so these Greek philosophers were naturally going up the wrong way, mathematically limited by not having calculus, I believe. He complains that they naively adopted the view that no fundamental entropy or substance comes to be or perishes, the result being that they are unable to account for because they disallow substantial change, which is the very phenomena Aristotle is most interested in explaining, which is quite interesting. So, substantial change is where you get the causes and the matter. So you change the matter falling in. So, which is different from mass. Aristotle actually understands Parmenides' thesis that what is one, hen o un, and not subject to generation and change, as belonging not to natural philosophy, but to the first philosophy of metaphysics. Which is strange. So I think this is important to say that the first philosophy came to a dead end because they said they just reasoned nothing could change. In the complex treatment of Parmenides in physics, Aristotle introduces Parmenides together with Melius as representing the position with the Gorgianic doxographical schema, structuring his own examination of the Archae theories, ancient theories, that there is a single and unchangeable arche, or principle. Okay, this is a bit hard to get, so I'm going to have to go back and look at who Melissus is. And what does Gorgianic doxographical schema? I'll have to look that up if I can remember. I never remember it. It's my poor brain, it's not working. Aristotle recognizes, however, this grouping obscures the very real differences between the two thinkers' views. According to Aristotle, Melesius held that everything is a single, i.e., continuous, indivisible, unlimited quantity or extension. Parmenides, on Aristotle's reconstruction, recognizes the only use of being indicating that something is in respect of its substance or essence. He accordingly supposed that everything is substance. So that you can just, that is substance. He supposed everything to be more in the sense that the account of the essence of everything is identical. So, this is, I'd hate to say it, but in terms of respectfully dumb ideas. So, Melesius is everything is just one thing, and Parmenides is everything is identical. But no accident of what just is can belong to its essence. And since Parmenides emits only a use of being indicates what something is can be said. Which sort of rather goes into Aristotle trying to wrap up the ancients while he had its four causes, I suppose. Such is the thrust of Aristotle's reconstructions of Parmenides' reasoning in physics, and likewise of his summary allusion to this passage at Metaphysics. So Aristotle is several generations after Plato. He's, I think, 330 BC. Working with Alexander, he's doing an awful lot of work. Aristotle. There's only the only point where Aristotle's representations of Parmenides in Metaphysics appears to differ with a major treatment in physics is in that. So Metaphysics is to do with actual philosophy, and physics is that's what we call science, explanation of things. And I can tell you, it is absolutely ruthlessly death to try and read it yourself. It is in following up this summary with the qualification that being compelled to go with the phenomena and supposing that what is one with respect to the account, but plural with respect to the perception. He posited the duality of principles as the basis of his account of phenomena, as per Alexander of Aphrodisias' paraphrase. I'm just trying to absorb what that could possibly mean. Sorry, you're hearing it, I'm reading it. We're both in this together. This is only a superficial difference given how at physics Aristotle points out the Parmenidean duality of principles to support his thesis that all his predecessors have made opposite principles, including those who maintain that everything is one and unchanging. Nonetheless, the representation of Parmenides' position in Metaphysics, according to which what is one with respect to the account of its essence, but plural with respect to its possession, is more indulgent than the reconstruction of Parmenides' reasoning in physics, in that it allows for differentiated aspects of what is. So, I can sort of accept that there's actually one only physical entity, but it can be perceived in many different ways. By allowing what is may be differentiated with respect to the phenomenal qualities, Aristotle seemed to have recognized at some level the mistake in assuming that Parmenides' failure to distinguish explicitly among the senses of being entails that he could only have employed the term in one sense. Oh dear, that's quite hard. Despite the assimilation of Meleses and Parmenides under the rubric inherited by Gorgias, so there's another person, there's three people here. We only know, well, there's Meleses, Parmenides, and Gorgias, who is intermediary between Aristotle. Aristotle recognized that the grouping of the two figures together under the convenient label obscured the fundamental differences in their positions. The fact is that monism, which is this monad, this famous thing which has led to our digital age, it's pretty amazing, does not denote a unique metaphysical position, but a family of positions. Among its species are strict monism, or the position that is just one thing exists. Oh, okay. So the actual ancients believe that this is a whole graded thing. Okay. Understand where they're going from. So this is white spectral. So rather than grouping, he said, look, these can be put on a continuum, a line. Among its species are strict monisms, or the position that just one thing exists. This is the position of Meleses advocated, one which no serious metaphysician should want to adopt. Okay, more familiar species include both numerical and generical substances monism, according to which, respectively, there is a single substance or a single kind of substance. Aristotle seems ultimately to have inclined towards attributing this first type of generous monism to Parmenides. So he's got, it's not strict monism, he's saying that there's not just a thing, and it's the only thing that exists, and that we're all, I don't know how this goes together. But it's interesting that philosophy has really come to an end with advanced physics, I would say. In viewing Parmenides as a generous monist, whose positions allow for the existence of other entities, rather than a strict monist holding that only one thing exists, Aristotle is in accord with the majority view of Parmenides in the Antiquities. That some in antiquity viewed Parmenides as a strict monist is evidence from Putrias' reports of the Epicurean Colet's treatments of Parmenides in his treatise. Treatise, okay, we'll talk about what the treatise is and what Epicurus is. That one cannot live according to the doctrine of other philosophers. Okay, now, Epicurus was a philosopher, and indeed he's given his philosophy is of enjoying life. But it's not, we have got this into gluttony, we've sort of commercial people have got in on him, but Epicurus was to enjoy life, and that things act separately but in a coordinated way. He had a very interesting view. So Epicurean, there's this person called Colets, it's a Putriacs. Putriacs is a Putriacs is a philosopher, a Roman philosopher in 1 AD, I think. And Epicurus is back in there, and after Epicurus is this guy called Colots. I'm going to look up what Meleses is, because he's whacked. And Epicurus is worthwhile going. Okay, so he's saying, hey, you cannot use the doctrines of other philosophers. Well, his main claim appears to have been that Parmenides... prevents us from living by maintaining that the universe is one, hentupan, a tag which Colets apparently took to mean that Parmenides denied the existence of fire, water, and indeed the inhabited cities of Europe and Asia. He may have also claimed that if one accepts Parmenides' thesis, there will be nothing to prevent one from walking off a passage, since in his view there is no such things. In short, Pultriat reports, Collot said that, quote, Parmenides abolishes everything by hypothesizing that being is one. Pritchard himself, however, takes a strong issue with Collett's views, charging him with imputing to Parmenides disgraceful sophism. Oh, what does that mean? You're a stupid philosopher. And with deliberately misconstruing his position. That's interesting. The debate's really going strong at 1 AD. That's what they're talking about today. They're not talking about inflation or the Vandals coming in or the fall of the Roman Empire. They're talking about dissipating down themselves. Bruchiatz explains, and so Bruchiatz, I think, is a Roman person, I'm not sure, but he's after Christ, explains that Parmenides was in fact the first to distinguish between the mutable objects of sensation and the unchanging character of the intelligible. See, that's a beautiful, i.e. love, faith, maths, numbers exist throughout the universe. Number one doesn't come into it. Number, or pi, has existed throughout all time. That's pretty amazing. Parmenides abolishes neither nature, instead assigning to each what is appropriate. He places the intelligible in a class of what is one and one being, calling it a being, insofar it is eternal and imperishable, and one because of its likeness to itself and not to admitting differentiation, while he locates the perceptible among what is disordered and changing. That's actually quite a smart move. Okay. Pritchard insists that Parmenides' distinction between what is what really is and things which are what they are at one time or in one context, but not another, should not be misconstrued as an abolition of the latter class of entities, which I think you could possibly have to say, given that how could he possibly after the first one? It's just the goddess he was talking, it's the goddess in me. How could he have let perception and doxia remain without leaving the apprehended, leaving what is apprehended by perception and doxa? So what the heck does doxa mean? This is the thing. You're here reading it with me. They suddenly introduced this word doxa. I'm sure if I said doxa in Scrabble, I'd be killed. So what is doxa? That's another thing for me to rack my brain and think about. Pritchard's discussion of Parmenides in Against Collet's. What? Oh, he really hates this guy. So it's Collet's. So there's Melissinus, which I'll have to read, and Collet's. He's speaking of sequence in that it is a substantial discussion of the relation between his account of being and his cosmology by the ancient author, later than Aristotle, that is not overtly influenced by Aristotle's own discussions. This is a problem with Simplicitas. This is another dude. In many ways, this anticipates the Neoplatonic interpretation represented by Simplicitas. According to which, so he's a Roman dude, according to which, broadly speaking, the two accounts delivered by Parmenides' goddess describes two levels of reality, the immutable intelligible realm and the plural change in a sensible realm, especially Simplicitas' commentary on Aristotle. So, I think they're just really girding up, and this, I think, really tells you the advantage of, if you have a simply polarized view, you just get self stuck. This is my overall view on almost every subject. However, you've got this sort of advance comes in non-polarized views. Power comes with polarized views. This is my quote. Okay, later Platonists. So this is people in Plato's school. So Plato had the theory of forms, which I'll have to go back. I'll have to reread Plato. I'll have to read the Republic later. So Plato had an ideal form, and we recognize the form. So Plato mixed these two together, and you can actually see Plato's idea that you have the concept of the ideal chair, and you come along and you identify the ideal chair. And he also said there's a Platonic view of virtue, which is an idea where we see images of virtue. Later Platonists naturally understood Parmenides as anticipating Plato. Plato himself seems to have adopted a Platonist understanding of this thinker, who influences his own philosophy every bit as profound as that of Socrates and the Pythagoreans, which is truly the Plato's theories of forms really comes out of this. So I can sort of see where the benefit of this. So Plato's theories of form is you have the form of perfect state, the perfect love, chair, rock, and he was saying that we see these forms. Now I'll have to go back and really read it completely. Aristotle attributes to both Parmenides and Plato the recognition that knowledge requires as its objects certain natures and entities not susceptible to change. But Parmenides in De Caelo, to Parmenides in De Caelo, and to Plato in remarkably similar language in Metaphysics. The arguments at the end of Republic 5, which is written by... Republic's written by Plato, and I'd love to read Republic. They confirm Aristotle's. Attribution of this line of reasoning to Plato are in fact sufficed with echoes of Parmenides. Now that's a really confused line. So Plato wrote this Republic before Aristotle. But if you read it, you can see that what Aristotle's saying is correct. Plato likewise has the fictionalized, so this is understanding, the fictionalized Parmenides presents something very close to this line of argument in the dialogue bearing his name. Okay, so Plato, with Republic and everything, these are screenplays or teledocumentaries. Nowadays would be made by PBSs into documentaries, where things were fictionalized to explain things. And so this is why Plato, in his way of writing, fictionalized these characters. I just get my head around it. And I really try to get my head around the theory of forms. Melesinus and Doxo. What the heck is Doxo? Plato had his fictionalized Parmenides present some very close to this line of argument in his dialogue bearing his name. So Plato wrote a screenplay, if you'd like it, or a play, called Parmenides, and he had fictionalized Parmenides speak in it. If someone will not admit that there are general kinds of entities and will not specify some form for each individual thing, we will have nowhere to turn intellect, since he does not admit that there is a character for each of these things that is which also is the same in the manner he will destroy the possibility of discourse altogether. The Platonic natures, so that makes sense, so you have these immutable ideas. The Platonic natures Aristotle has in mind are clearly the forms that Plato himself, said the theory of forms, FOIMs, clearly the forms that Plato himself is prone to describing in a language that echoes the attributes to a Parmenidean being, most notably and Symposium. So Symposium is another play. It's not produced or made into film, or some people, and Phaedo. So that's another play, another script. Plato's forms are made to look like the plurality of the Parmenidean's beings. It might seem to supply Platonic authority for the meta-principled interpretation. This would be rash conclusion, however, for Plato consistently represents Parmenides as a monist in his later dialogues. So you have to, I don't think modern people will possibly understand what a monist is. I don't think it's something we can understand in our modern civilization. It's just my view. Judging just what type of monism Plato means to attribute to Parmenides in these dialogues ultimately requires plunging into the intricacies of examination of Parmenides' thesis in the later part of the book he wrote, The Plague, called Parmenides. So this is deep. So you got to think, in the ancient world they were producing tele-documentaries, but not in, you know, no television. And I can obviously see an understanding, and it's, I think this is a fairly good, I can't see these interpretations as contradictories. Plato's understanding of Parmenides is best reflected in that dialogue's exploration of his thesis of the second deduction. Oh yeah, deduction. They didn't have induction back then. There is the one, capital O-N-E, is shown to have a number of properties that is related, those Parmenides himself attributed to being in the course of fragment A. That is itself and the same as itself. That is, that it is at rest, and that it is like itself, that it cannot, that it is not in contact with itself, etc. In the second deduction, that actually, just being not in contact with self speaks to me of a wave function. In the second deduction, all these properties prove to belong to the one in virtue of its own nature in relation to itself. This deduction also allows that the one has apparently contrary attributes, so these prove to belong to it in other respects, that is, not in virtue of its own nature and or in relation to itself. Whatever the heck does that mean? Plato would have found a model for his complex account of the various seemingly conflicting properties of the one in the two major phrases of Parmenides' poem if he too ascribed an aspectral interpretation to Parmenides according to the way of conviction described the cosmos as an intelligible aspect of quiet being, while allowing that description is compatible with alternate descriptions of this self-same entity as a world system comprised of differential and changing objects. Okay, so they're saying that the ancients had the spectral view, and the spectral view of different philosophers, but within a philosophy. These two perspectives are notably reflected respectively in the Time Missus, so which is another screenplay by Plato. So it produces heaps of time screenplays, or dialogues, descriptions of the intelligible living creature and of the visible cosmos modelled upon it, both of which are suffused with the echoes of Parmenides' sea. A huge amount of things. So we keep on going on the spectral view, page after page. The Aristotle, so you have to understand that Aristotle was a student of Plato, or I think it may be one generation between Plato and Aristotle. So Aristotle was the head of the academy. Plato was the head of the academy. There's someone in between the head. So it could have been that Colistus, something or other. That Aristotle also viewed the two major phrases in Parmenides' poem as a dual, phases of Parmenides' poem as dual accounts of the same entity in different aspects is perhaps most apparent in its characterization of Parmenides in the course on discussion of metaphysics. So you can see that if you don't have Parmenides, like it's really intractable, but if you don't have it, you can't understand what these guys are talking about. If you don't understand what he's doing, you can't understand a dialogue of Plato, you can't understand his form. And then Aristotle's got a large critique of it, and you can't understand where it's all come from. So it's really interesting. in the course of a discussion of metaphysics as having supposed that, quote, what is one in account but plural in respects to perception. Someone else, another dude called Theophrastus, likewise seems to have adopted such a line, whoever he is. He's a dude who's walked down. Alexander of Aphrodisias, oh, that's a great thing, there must have been a place. Aphrodisias quotes him as having written of the following Parmenides in the first book of his on natural philosophers. Coming after Xenophanes, Parmenides of Ella, son of Pyrrhus, went along both paths. So I've got to find out Xenophanes, Melitus, and Doxo. You're a Doxo. For he both declares that the universe is eternal and so attempts to explain the generation of things that are through without taking the same view of them both, but supposing that in accordance with the truth of the universe is one and ungenerated spherical in shape, while in the accordance with the view of the multitude and with a view of explaining the generation of things as they appear to us, making the principles to fire and earth as one matter, the other the cause, the agent. That is seriously crazy. So that they had, oh, now the interesting thing is Parmenides had ether, and also Aristotle had ether. That's an interesting thing. But you have what is and what causes this bringing up. Many of Theophrastus's points here can be tracked back to Aristotle, including the identification of Parmenides' elemental light and night, respectively, fire functioning as the fission principle on earth, functioning as a material principle. The passage on the whole suggests that, like Plato and Aristotle, Theophrastus understood Parmenides as furnishing dual accounts of the universe, first as intelligible and then as phenomenal aspects. Now that is really interesting. I.e. that I can actually go with that, and you can see that in the forms of Plato. While it would be going too far to claim that Plato, Aristotle, Theophrastus, and the ancient thinkers who follow their broad view of Parmenides as a generous monist got Parmenides right on all points, nonetheless, the impulse towards correcting or just ignoring the ancient evidence of pre-Socratic thought. Has in the case gone too far. Both Plato and Aristotle understood Parmenides as perhaps the first to have developed the idea of apprehension of what is unchanging and is different in order to of the order of epistemology than the apprehension of things subject to thing to change. That is really interesting. So Parmenides has now come out as the father, the real father of things. More fundamentally, Plato and Aristotle both came to understand Parmenides as a type of generous monist, whose conception of what belongs more to theology or the first philosophy than to natural science. This involved understanding Parmenides' cosmology as his own accounts of the world insofar as it's subject to change. It also involved understanding the first part of Parmenides' poem as metaphysical in the proper Aristotelian sense of being concerned with what is not subject to change and enjoys a non-dependent existence. Most importantly, both Plato and Aristotle recognized that the distinction between the fundamental modalities or the ways of being as central to Parmenides' systems. None of these major points is tainted by the kind of obvious anachronism that rightly makes one suspicious, for instance, about Aristotle's identification of Parmenides' light and night with the elements of fire and earth. None of these broad points, in other words, involves Plato or Aristotle viewing Parmenides through the distorting lens of their own conceptual apparatus. The next session will continue to outline the view of Parmenides' philosophical achievement that resulted from attending to his modal distinctions and to his epistemological distinctions he builds upon them. Thank you.
podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.